the lecture today by just reviewing some of the results that you guys got in the second part of the tutorial yesterday. So I think most of you that are here right now were in the tutorial yesterday, but if you weren't, you can look up the question in the Dropbox of what we did. But basically we were doing a task of classification using supervised learning. So we were taking some data that had some noise added to it, and we were studying how well a feed-forward neural network could learn that data and learn how to classify it. So you guys had different tasks depending on what group you were in. The first results I want to look at are how the accuracy of the network scales with the number of neurons that you have in your hidden layer. So if you remember, initially when I gave you the tutorial, you just had an input layer and an output layer, and one thing you did was to add a hidden layer, but you can have various number of neurons in that layer. So here we're studying how the accuracy behaves of how well we're able to classify our data based on the number of neurons. And what this group found was that in general, this accuracy increases with the number of neurons, which I think probably makes sense if you think about it, that as we have more neurons, we have more fitting parameters in our function. So you would expect that that function would be able to describe a wider range of data. So the accuracy should get better as you add more and more neurons because you can generalize well. I can't quite tell if it's always increasing or not. Maybe at some points it's slightly decreasing. But that's okay because here we didn't really average over many random seeds or anything. And I think, I'm not sure depending on which group you were in. I know some groups were really careful that their results were really converged, that there wasn't any more change when they plotted this. But maybe in some cases, some of the code needed to run for a greater number of epochs. And another big factor is that in a lot of cases, this algorithm can get stuck in local minima. So we kind of talked about that a bit yesterday, and we'll talk about it more today. But in cases where you see that maybe your data in some of these plots is not monotonic, I think it could definitely be an indication that you're getting stuck or you're not converged. So this is where the first results in that group. Next, a couple of different groups studied the accuracy compared with the magnitude of the noise. And some groups sent me a lot of different plots, and so I just kind of chose one from each group just because I really today just want to discuss the idea. But thanks to you guys for sending so many results and being so careful with documenting all of your parameters. So now in this case, in the first plot that I showed, we were kind of studying how the accuracy depends on a feature of your network. But in this case, it's more a feature of your data. So we're studying how much noise your data has. So we started with these spirals of data, and then we added different amounts of noise. So this parameter mag noise just compared how much noise was added to your data. And again, as you might expect, as we add more noise, it becomes more and more difficult to get good accuracy on the data. So I think in the one on the left, this group was not even 100% accuracy even when there was no noise. I can't remember what the other parameters were, but I think in both of these cases, actually, you might have got smoother results if you had trained a little bit longer. I know in this group, you got lots of different data points, which is really great, but I think I remember you saying you didn't train for that many epochs. So probably here, a lot of these results weren't converged, and they might have looked smoother if we just ran the code for a little bit longer so that it could keep finding a better solution. Okay, and in this case, we were looking at the accuracy versus the number of different branches in the data. So to start off with, I gave you code that just had three different classes, but then you could extend this to be, you could study this as a function of the number of branches. And again, I think the results that are found here are what would be expected. So this is studying how the accuracy behaves on K, which is the number of branches. And we would expect that as we're trying to classify more and more different classes, it would become more difficult. So, and that's indeed what we see in these plots, that as a general trend, the accuracy was going down with the number of different labels that we were trying to classify. And this group on the right, you guys sent me a few different nice plots with different learning rates. So I chose the one actually with the highest learning rate, which I think is not the best out of the plots that you had, but I wanted to include it just because you saw this bump here. So again, I think this is an indication that probably this learning rate is maybe too high in some of these cases. Maybe it's jumping over some of your minima. It's not for sure. I can't tell for sure just by looking at this plot. But when you guys studied, I think a lot of the parameters were the same, but you lowered the learning rate. You saw something much smoother. So I think this could be an indication that your step size was too high in this case, so that it wasn't always actually able to reach the minima the way that you wanted it to. So again, I think the things I want you to take away from this tutorial problem would just be this idea of noticing when your data is maybe not smooth or it looks kind of noisy, that I think in a lot of these cases that corresponds either to not converging your code, not running for long enough, or maybe getting stuck somewhere. So just keep that in mind as we talk about some alternative algorithms today. Do you guys have any questions about this? About any of the results you found in the tutorial? Okay, so one more thing before we move to the chalkboard. I just wanted to say one more thing about something from the tutorial. I just want to discuss this concept of overfitting, because I've said this word a lot, but I haven't maybe really given a very clear example of what I mean. So here I ran the code from yesterday, and I just ran it on a case where I really increased the number of hidden units. So the number of hidden neurons in this case was 100, whereas initially we started off with it just being 4. And so I want to talk about why this is interesting. So if you look at this plot here, so I also increased the noise a little bit here. So there's quite a bit of noise in this data. But we do know that ideally this data is spirals plus noise. And that's really what we would kind of like the function to fit to. But we can see what it's fitting is something quite different than just a smooth spiral kind of shape. So for example, here it's getting this kind of weird feature showing up here. And another thing is over here on the very left of this plot, you can see that there's this one yellow point that maybe is very noisy, happens to be very different from the spiral shape. But the network has kind of created a whole new region of space just to get that one point. Whereas we would probably expect that actually on average, that region of space would probably actually correspond to the purple region. But because this data is so noisy and we're giving the network so many fitting parameters, it's actually doing these weird things where it's making these strange regions of space just to fit this noisy data. So you can look on the right that actually when we look at the cost, for example, it's continuing to go down. It looks very smooth. The training accuracy here, I think, is basically exactly one. So it's classifying every point correctly. But actually, I think probably most of you would agree that this is not really what we would want, right? We don't really want these functions to be fitting noise. We want them to be fitting the actual data that we wanted to see. So so in this case, for example, we probably have too many hidden neurons is one thing. And so what a big part of today is going to be about is diagnosing when you're overfitting. And then tomorrow, we're going to talk about different ways to prevent this. So different ways that we can modify the algorithms that we use so that we prevent overfitting. So I don't need the screen anymore, so if you guys can put it back up. Thank you. Okay, so I wrote on the board here an outline of what we're going to talk about today. So yesterday, we started talking about learning algorithms and how they adjust the weights and biases in our network in order to optimize them. And specifically, we looked at the case of an algorithm called gradient descent, or I'll just abbreviate that as GD. So today, we'll look at a few other algorithms. And a lot of them are still based on gradient descent, but they just modify it in some way. So we'll look at ways that you can make gradient descent better. Then we'll talk about the concept of backpropagation, which is needed to compute the gradients in your feedforward neural networks. And then, as I kind of just alluded to, we'll start talking about overfitting and how you can recognize when you're overfitting when you're doing some of these classification tasks. Any questions about that? So let's talk, as I said, about learning algorithms. which is basically continuing from yesterday. So just to review, okay, so just to remind you, we're trying to find the optimal values of parameters in our network. In these algorithms, I'm just gonna call, many of the times I'll just call these parameters P with some label, but really these are weights and biases that we kind of index in a more complicated way. So this is the goal. So you remembered we might have some cost function that looks something like this in a certain region of space. And we're trying, ideally, we're trying to find the absolute minimum of this function. And that's what we're trying to design algorithms to do. Oh, and I should mention, I forgot to say that I posted the lecture notes before lecture today. So if you guys look on the Dropbox or the PSI wiki, the notes that I usually upload after class, I did them before class today. In case you guys don't prefer not to take notes, you can just follow along. Okay, and then just to remind you, in the gradient descent algorithm, we update our parameters by calculating gradients of the cost function and then taking a step that's proportional to this gradient and this learning rate here. And I think what a lot of you noticed in yesterday's tutorial, that the results of how well your network does depend a lot on your learning rate. So I know initially the code wasn't always working, but if you, in the case of yesterday's tutorial, you needed to increase the learning rate for some of the first problems to get it to work well. But in other cases, it of course could be the opposite. You might need to decrease it. It might be a lot smaller than you might think. Okay, so let's now look at alternatives to this gradient descent method. So the first one is something that's very often used, which is called stochastic gradient descent, or SGD. So to describe this, in talking about this, we're just going to make an assumption that our cost function can be decomposed as a sum, basically a sum over elements in my data set times some function. So basically saying that we're sort of taking an average of the cost over all of our data points. So both of the cost functions we looked at yesterday, the mean squared error and the cross entropy, they both satisfy this. I just want to make it clear that in the arguments we talk about, we're sort of assuming that you have a cost function that looks like this, which I think in most cases makes sense, that you're just kind of averaging over the cost of every data point. So the idea here is that rather than doing this entire sum over our whole data set, we'll just sum over a smaller set of data when we need to calculate our gradients. And the data that we sum over, we'll call that a mini batch. So we'll specify a size m, which would be smaller than the size of our data. And we'll just kind of replace this sum with a sum over elements of our mini batch. So does anyone have an idea why doing something like this could be useful?
It's much faster.
Exactly. But that's a big one, right? It's much faster. We don't have to do such a big sum. Anything else? Yeah?
Is the algorithm less likely to remember one specific point?
Yeah, like one specific minimum, basically. Is that what you mean? Like one specific local minimum?
One specific data point, like the overfitting was solving
that. Ah, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, that it won't just be biased by one point that has a very high cost or something like that. Yeah, that's a good point, yeah. Yeah, I think just in general, the fact that it has this element of randomness built in so that you ignore some of your data is a benefit. So yeah, I think it means that you're kind of looking at your data in different ways every time. And this can mean that you can actually avoid getting stuck in local minima. Because if we have just basic gradient descent and our learning rate is very small, we know that eventually we'll converge to a minimum, but it won't necessarily be more than just a local minimum. So in this case, we might be able to explore other minima in our code more easily. Okay, so this is a really powerful way to change your gradient descent algorithm, and we'll use this in some of the other codes that we look at in the tutorials and the homework. And I think you'll see that it's very helpful. So another thing that we can do in our learning algorithms is that we can add something called momentum. And the idea here is that rather than just caring about what our current gradient is when we take a step, we have a memory of what gradients we have seen recently before. So we introduce this momentum or this memory parameter v. And so under an update, we update this memory parameter, and then we use that to update the parameters of our network. So in here, in talking about this method, I have to introduce yet another hyperparameter. So if you remember, we've already seen lots of hyperparameters that we kind of have to choose when we're designing our networks and our training algorithms. One is the learning rate that we've already seen, the number of neurons, the number of layers. These are all hyperparameters that we have to find a way of choosing somehow before doing our training. And now this gamma is just yet another hyperparameter that we have to introduce if we want to use this method. And just want to make it clear that if you set this gamma to zero, you're just basically not remembering any of your previous gradients, and that just corresponds to your regular gradient descent that we've seen before. So one important benefit associated with adding momentum is that it helps to avoid problems that we can sometimes get into when our gradients get very small. So you might remember that yesterday when we talked about some different activation functions, we saw that sometimes they get very flat. And you can see that if our gradient is getting very small, then that also corresponds to taking very small steps in our parameters. So sometimes our algorithm gets stuck when our gradients are very small. So by introducing this memory, we see that even if we end up in a very flat region of our landscape, that as long as it hasn't been flat for a very, very, very long time, then we could still make changes in our parameter and not get stuck too much.
Velocity, or does it?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. I think you just initialize it to zero because you just don't remember anything from the beginning, as far as I remember. I can't. Yeah, because you wouldn't really know what. Yeah, I think there's no reason to initialize it to anything else. So you basically start by doing regular gradient descent, and then you start remembering. So V would be zero initially, and then your gamma. I mean, just like we're going to talk just now about how you can. Make your learning rate adaptive so you can adjust it so that usually you'll make it smaller as you go on, so you start taking smaller steps. You could probably also do that for this momentum parameter, that it could also change with time. But I think in most cases you would set V to zero initially, and then your gamma you could start off with it just being constant. That would be the simplest implementation. Any other questions? Okay. So the last thing I want to talk about . Somebody brought this up yesterday, and it's a really important point as well that I just kind of said out loud, is this idea of adapting the learning rate. So the idea here is that we can introduce an algorithm that somehow determines what this learning rate should be depending on what our landscape looks like. So depending on how our gradients are and how they've been behaving. And another thing we can do is we can allow this learning rate to be different depending on which parameter we're looking at. Sorry, just one second. I just want to make this last point, and which is that so normally we didn't have any index p on this learning rate, but it could definitely have a p dependence. So it could be different depending on which parameter you're adjusting. Yeah, question.
Yeah, just a question on the momentum thing. So that's just the benefit, it can still learn when the gradient is flat. Don't I want to find this region where the gradient is flat or zero?
Yeah, so I guess I'm referring more to regions. So I think if you're at a minimum, then your gradient, and if you're taking a small enough step, your gradient will be small for a long time. I guess I'm talking more about regions of space that could look something like this, where you could have a flat region. Maybe it's not even a minimum, it's a maximum. You could get stuck in regions like this.
Okay.
Yeah.
But so, I mean, still though, when I think about this momentum thing, so I'm at the minimum, but it still changes, so it goes away from my optimum that I'm going to find.
It should still take steps in the direction of lowering your cost function if your step size is small enough. Like, as long as it's similar to gradient descent, I believe that as long as this eta parameter is small enough, that you should be taking steps going towards a minimum. So I think if you have a flat minimum, I think it should still take steps along this flat direction. It would maybe just allow it to take bigger steps, but it'll still go in the direction of decreasing the cost.
But there's no overshooting going on, so
there can be. You have to be careful about choosing these hyperparameters. So what I'm saying is, in the ideal case, if you were able to choose this learning rate and this momentum parameter in an optimal way, which is not easy, it's not easy to choose them optimally, but if you could, then yeah, you would avoid overshooting and you would reach a minimum. And adding this momentum could help you do it faster. But in practice, it's hard to choose those parameters correctly. And if you choose your learning rate to be too high, for example, you can overshoot your minimum. So you kind of have to play with all of these things. You have to kind of adjust your learning rate. You have to adjust this momentum hyperparameter. You have to adjust your batch size. And you can study the performance using different metrics, and you kind of try to figure out what's the best value of these different hyperparameters. But yeah, you definitely can still overshoot. It's just that these are kind of maybe ways to make your algorithm a bit more robust. Yeah.
So I don't get intuition why adding the momentum keeps some memory in the gradient.
So we can go through one step of the algorithm maybe. Maybe that'll make it more clear. So I think, correct me if I make a mistake, because I didn't write this down in my notes, but initially, let's say we put v is equal to 0, and our parameters will initialize them in some random way to p naught. Then we would calculate our cost function. So then this will be v at step, sorry, let's use a different notation. V0, this will be step 0. This will be some P initial. Then we'll do one step, and our V will go to, this part will just be 0. So this will be minus eta times, so this will just be our gradient. And then our parameter, in this case, would go to its initial value plus V, which would be minus the gradient. So the first step would just be a regular gradient descent step. And then if we did another step of this algorithm, V2, so then this case we would go to gamma, and I should put here, this would be P naught. This would be the gradient with respect to P naught. So then in this case, I would here get this times minus eta gradient of P naught times C, and then I would be subtracting my current gradient. So you could see in this parameter now, I would have some memory of a previous gradient, and then I would have my next gradient. So this one would be weighted smaller, right? Because this parameter is less than 1. So the current gradient would be more important, but I would also be considering previous ones. And then now I should call this P1, sorry. Then my new parameter would be the previous value, P initial, which is this. Again, I might have made a typo here because I don't like to do math on the fly because I often make mistakes. But and then we would add in all of this. I'll just write V2. But you can see that there would be some memory of the previous gradients. Does it make sense now?
Yeah.
Any other questions? Yeah.
Could you say that this parallels Monte Carlo techniques in a way? So stochastic gradient descent is just basic Monte Carlo. Momentum could be like Hamiltonian Monte Carlo. Adaptive learning
I haven't thought it through of whether it, like, how analogous that really is. But I think so. When you're adding these elements, especially when you add these elements of randomness, I think that definitely makes me think
like adaptive learning, right? It sounds like simulated annealing when your accept reject rate or willingness to accept reject goes down as you sample.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, this is. I wouldn't be surprised if this is actually more well established in the literature. I just don't know it off the top of my head. But yeah, I think that's a cool point. For sure. Yeah, so I think there's definitely a lot of interplay between Monte Carlo methods and machine learning methods. So sometimes we kind of talk about comparing machine learning to Monte Carlo, but then there's also Monte Carlo within machine learning. So. Any other questions? Okay. So again, I just wanted to emphasize the possibility of adapting your learning rate. So there's various ways that you can do this. There's many algorithms that will adapt the learning rate. I'll just tell you a couple that you could look up. One is called the Atom Optimizer. And another is called RMS prop, so root mean squared propagation. And I should emphasize, ATOM is actually not an acronym. It doesn't stand for anything. It's just called ATOM. So I'm not giving you guys right now the details of these algorithms, but the reason I think they're worth mentioning is just because when you're playing around with code, you can actually just change one line of your TensorFlow code. Right now, there's a line that tells it to use gradient descent. And you can just say, oh, use the Atom Optimizer or use the RMS prop. So it's kind of worthwhile, I think, to play around with these different learning algorithms. Um, So if you just Google tf.train, or tensorflow.train, you'll come up with a page that'll just list many different learning algorithms that you can use when you're using TensorFlow. Okay, so we've talked about a lot of these different learning algorithms, and we can see that all of the ones we've seen so far would rely on knowledge of these gradients of our cost function, but we actually haven't talked about how to compute those gradients, so that's what I want to talk about now. So this is what we're going to use to compute these gradients of our cost function, which we need in order to update our parameters. So it's fairly straightforward to calculate these gradients when we're talking about parameters in the last layer of our network. And the reason is that our cost function is just written directly in terms of the output from our last layer. Okay, so that case, we'll actually go through what it is. But that's the easiest one to calculate, is the parameters in your last layer. So the idea of the algorithm and kind of the motivation for why it's called backpropagation is that we start at the last layer, we compute the gradients there, and then we're going to use those gradients to compute the gradients at the layers that are one layer backwards. So just to write that maybe a bit more formally, is that we start with the last layer, and then when we want to calculate the gradients at a layer L, we first calculate them at a layer L plus 1. So this point here is a pretty minor point, and I'll move it up. I just want to emphasize that Remember that our cost function is a sum of costs over all of our data points. So in the algorithms we look at, I just want to make it really clear that we're going to compute the gradient just corresponding to one data point in the notation that I'm going to use. But then you would just average over all of these costs in order to calculate your full gradient. Or maybe you're just going to average over the mini batch if you're using stochastic gradient descent. But just to make it clear, we're just going to do the gradients of these cost functions corresponding to a single point. Although you could generalize it in the notation if you want. OK, I'll move this up so you can see it. So I just want to remind you guys of the notation we introduced yesterday. So remember that we said that the output from a network is computed by taking the activation function applied to some with an argument that's called z. And then this z is computed from the outputs of the previous layer. OK, so now I just want to introduce a definition of this new parameter that we'll call delta, which will just be the derivative of the cost function with respect to this z variable. And then we'll relate this back to the gradients that we want. So as I said earlier, the way that we start backpropagation is by considering the last layer. So let's just look at what this parameter is for the very last layer. So I see that I can actually compute this delta for this last layer by just taking the derivative of my cost function with respect to the output of the last layer. And remember that this cost function is very clearly a function of that variable. And then I just look at the derivative of my activation function. So let's call this equation 1. Then I don't want to go through the whole calculation of how you do this on the other layers, because you guys will do this for the first part of homework 2. But I'll just tell you the answer. And I'll also write out the answer for you again when I give you the homework. You have to remember. Thank you. Okay, so we can then go through a calculation and we'll find that if I want to calculate this delta parameter on a layer that's not the last layer, I use this formula. So the important thing I want you to note now is just that I'm computing this delta using the delta from a higher layer. So whereas when I calculate the output from the layer, I start from the left and I use to calculate input at a layer L, I use input from a layer L minus 1. Here we're going in the opposite direction when we want to calculate these gradients. So you guys will show this in the homework, but really this is the idea, or this is the means that you use in order to calculate these gradients that we want in order to perform our learning algorithm. Okay. So I think in the last 2 days, we've talked a lot about these feed-forward neural networks, the learning algorithms that we use, the architecture of these networks. And we've been talking so far a lot about how we do the training. So this training has a lot of components. So what I want to just do before I talk about overfitting is just kind of write out pseudocode for really how this training works. Because in the TensorFlow code, you're often just calling a function that does this for you, but I think it's really important to understand how it's working in case you ever need to implement it yourself or maybe you want to make a modification to one of these algorithms. Okay, so the first thing I just want to note is that we're gonna loop over all of the elements of our data set. So I kind of mentioned this before, that these algorithms, we're sort of just writing them out for a single element, a cost function corresponding to a single element, I should say. But really, we're going to average over all elements. So I'll start with a for loop there. So then the first thing that I need to do for these algorithms is I need to calculate the output for my network for this given value of x. So for this, as we talked about yesterday, we do a forward pass. We use this activation function and our current weights and biases, and we propagate the information from left to right. Okay. And then, in order to update our weights and biases, we have to do this back propagation algorithm. So the first thing we do is we calculate this delta parameter on our last layer. Okay, so the next thing I do, as I said, I loop backwards. So from the last layer to the first, so I get this delta parameter, and then I use these formulas that I showed you there that you'll derive in the homework to calculate the gradients corresponding to all the parameters in that layer. Okay, so that's the backpropagation step. And then, now I end my... So then I close my loop over my data set. I need to do this averaging procedure to calculate the gradients with respect to my whole cost function. And then I do my update. Okay, and all of this loop I would call this whole for loop here is my gradient descent here. And of course, what I wrote here is just kind of the simplest implementation using just this normal gradient descent. But you can use something more sophisticated. You can use one of these other alternatives that I mentioned. And then you would just have to slightly modify this code so that you're maybe not looping over the whole data set, for example. Do you guys have any questions about that?
So,
yeah?
Stochastic gradient descent will be a for over a mini batch.
Yeah, for one epoch, you would, I guess it depends how you define an epoch. Sometimes I think people refer to an epoch as looking at every element of your data set one time. So then you would need to maybe loop over a few different mini batches until you've covered your whole data set. But the most naive modification, yeah, would just be that you choose a mini batch at random and then you loop over that batch instead of looping over the whole data set. Does it make sense?
So, but what is the standard thing to do?
What is the
standard thing to do? Do people generally take the whole data set, they divide it into mini batches, and then they do a loop over all the mini batches, and they call that epoch?
Yeah, exactly. So if my data set had 100 elements and my mini batch was size 25, I think the usual definition that people use would be that you would need to loop over 4 mini batches to cover all of your data. That would be considered one epoch. So you would have to do this loop 4 times because your mini batch is only a quarter of your data set in that case. But maybe, I mean, I think it's maybe sometimes just a question of what you're calling an epoch. Maybe other people would say an epoch is just one mini batch. You could say that if you wanted.
Because sometimes, I mean, typically your data set is super large.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so usually our data set's very large and we'll take our mini batch to just be a number such that it can, it's divisible by our data set size. Yeah, and then so we divide our data into mini batches. Yeah. Okay, so now, let's finally talk about this word that I keep saying of overfitting, which I'm sure you're all familiar with in other contexts, but let's just really talk about how to diagnose it in the context of these neural networks. So just to remind you what I mean when I say the word accuracy, because I'm going to use it a lot in this discussion. So what we mean is the percentage of time that the neural network gets the right prediction. So if you remember yesterday, our output was in this one hot encoding. So if we had k different labels, we were outputting the probability that the network thought it was each label. So maybe there were three different labels, it might output 0.8, 0.1, 0.1. In this case, its prediction would still be that first element, the one with the dominant probability, in this case, the largest probability. We'll say that that's its prediction. So when I say accuracy, I'm just saying the amount of time that it gets the right prediction after I round to the highest probability prediction. Okay, so I think in some of the plots you would have seen yesterday, you would have seen overfitting, and I showed you an example earlier on the slides. So we saw cases where our neural network was performing such that the cost function was decreasing, often in a very smooth way, and it was getting 100% accuracy on our plots. But from what we could see, it was overfitting. It was getting these weird features in the regions that it was predicting. And it was making all of these strange adjustments to the noise in our data. So we can tell that it was overfitting. But what we saw when we plotted these various functions if we plotted the cost, as I said, it was just going down nicely. And if I looked at the training accuracy, maybe it sometimes had kind of like a step function behavior, but it got to a point where it was basically getting 100% accuracy. So I think some of you saw plots that looked like this. So these two plots are not enough to diagnose whether we're overfitting, because as we can see here, everything looks good there. So does anyone have an idea of something we can do to recognize if we're overfitting? Yeah.
Split in training set and testing set?
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if you're reading the lecture notes because I posted them now. Everyone knows the answers to my questions. But I know you wouldn't. But that's exactly right. So what we can do is we can look at the accuracy not just on training data. We can look at other data. So the training data is used by the network to adjust the weights and biases, but we can generate other data and just never show it to the network when it's training. And we can still use it to look at the accuracy of this data that it hasn't seen before. Thank you. So as Arthur suggested, we can separate our data set into two categories, one for training and one for testing. Okay, so the training data, as I said, would be used to adjust the weights and biases, but the testing data would never be used in training. Okay. So what you might see, if you were to plot the testing accuracy in some of these cases where it was overfitting, you might see that initially the network is learning some of the features that we want. So this testing accuracy will increase along with the training accuracy. But then at some point, this testing accuracy will stop increasing. Either it will become relatively constant or it'll even start decreasing. And that's a really good indication that you're overfitting. If you test on this unseen data that was never used in training, and you see that it's not increasing, which ideally we want it to keep increasing. If this is not increasing, then we basically don't want to train using this method anymore, because there's no point. It's just fitting to specific cases that we've shown it. It's basically fitting to noise, is another way to say that. Yeah?
So the epoch refers to training steps. Mm-hmm. So how have I got a testing accuracy versus an epoch, which depends on training?
Yeah, so if we go back to our algorithm here, we do one epoch just the same way. And when we do this epoch, our loop is over the training data. That D set there is training data. But at the end, after I've done several epochs of training, I can compute accuracies. And I can compute those by doing a forward pass to calculate the output of my network. But I can use any kind of data to do that. So I'm going to calculate the output of my network for the training and the testing data, and I can see how well it did in both cases.
Asking, why plot it against epoch? Why not just take the end of your neural network, which you've already run for training, and just see what the accuracy is against your testing run?
Oh, so you can do that. It's just that's only one data point, basically. So I think what you're saying is if I trained for 1,000 epochs, I could, you know, stop here, and I would maybe get maybe 90% on my training data, and something not as good on my testing data, I could look at that one number. But I kind of want to see how this testing accuracy is behaving as I continue training. So the idea is I would train for a few epochs, and I would look at how well it's doing on this test data. And I would see, OK, it's increasing. I can keep going. It's still getting better. So then I would train again, and I would check again on my test data. So the idea is that when you do this loop, when you adjust your weights and biases, you're only using information about the training data to adjust those weights and biases. But you can still calculate the accuracy on any data. I don't know if I answered your question, though.
You did.
I did? Okay. Okay, good. Any other questions? Okay, so tomorrow we're going to talk about some methods that can actually help us to deal with these cases, so how we can actually modify our algorithms when we see overfitting. But for now, I just wanted to make it clear of some test we can do to see if we actually have this problem in our data. OK, so there's no tutorial today. Our next one will be tomorrow. And so I'll see you guys tomorrow morning.